Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
It's Wednesday, June 5th, 2013, and this is a special edition of KBIA's Views of the News. Special not because of this week's topics necessarily, but because we're making a big transition. I'm Mike McKean, director of the Futures Lab at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm joined today by four familiar voices, Lee Wilkins and Charles Davis, and Amy Simons and Ernest Perry. We had to switch sets in the RJI studio just to jam us all in, and we're mic'd up like a bunch of sportscasters. So what's the occasion? Well, after nearly 5 years together in our current configuration, we're breaking up the Views team. Lee is taking a new job in Michigan, Charles a new one in Georgia. Trying hard to take their places beginning next week are Amy and Ernest. We'll go into the whys and wherefores in a bit, but first let's get to our regular assignment, evaluating the performance of the news media. The Chicago Sun-Times decided last week to lay off all of its full-time photographers and start training reporters and editors to take pictures with iPhones. Among the dead from last week's killer tornadoes in Oklahoma are three storm chasers. Is the media appetite for disaster video causing too many people to take too many risks? And the Associated Press discovers top Obama administration officials have secret email addresses that might help them conduct official business with less scrutiny. First, we turn to Chicago, where all 28 of the Sun-Times' full-time photojournalists learned at a staff meeting they no longer had jobs. Sun-Times management said it made the move because it needed to shift resources to producing more online videos. One of those laid off is Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer John White. He lamented the loss on CNN's Reliable Sources.
Every time I capture a moment, it's timeless. It's forever. And it can be, it's like a light. It cannot be contained. And so we're these visual servants that's been behind the camera doing this work on a daily basis, from birth to death, everything in between. We cry more than we laugh, but we're there for people.
The paper will still pay the occasional freelancer to shoot breaking news, but managing editor Craig Newman also sent a memo to reporters and editors saying they would be responsible for capturing pictures and video using iPhones. Newman then announced training sessions that were slated to begin last Friday. When asked about that plan, White replied, quote, "You can't take someone who fills prescription bottles and have them do your heart surgery." The union that represents the laid-off workers plans to file a grievance with the National Labor Relations Board. Meanwhile, it's running this ad. For those of you who are listening to audio only, it shows a guy in a backwards ball cap and a Cubs t-shirt holding an iPhone. The copy reads in part, "Wanted freelance photojournalist. Hobbyists welcome. Is your portfolio full of photos of sunsets and static buildings? Great. PR people, send us your canned photos. We'll run them. Seriously, we will. Whatever they are, we've got nothing else to fill the space." Well, Amy, Chicago is your hometown, so why don't you get this discussion started?
Well, Chicago is my hometown, and in the interest of full disclosure, I also worked as a freelancer for the Chicago Sun-Times in the mid-90s covering high school sports. Also, as somebody who trains journalists to fill more than one role, to take photos and to write text stories, this actually pains me that all 28 of the photojournalists were laid off, that they have gotten rid of the entire department, because those photojournalists are the eyes of what's going on there. And yes, a reporter can go out with a notebook and can go out with an iPhone and can take some photographs, but they can't do both at the same time, and you're missing something. You can't be writing down a great quote at the same time you're taking a great photograph, and vice versa.
Well, Charles, is this about, as the news management said, just taking opportunities that they need to follow with online video, or is it about breaking the union, or what is it?
Pure union busting. I've really enjoyed all this sort of 35,000-foot navel-gazing about what this all means. What this means is that management saw an opportunity to whack an entire department, and then in about a year, year and a half, you'll start to see entry-level jobs coming back probably some of our students will be taking them, irony of ironies, and they will have reduced their pay scale by probably 75% between freelancers and contract laborers that will have no health insurance and will just be paid a stipend to take pictures. They'll be photojournalists and they'll be trained photojournalists, but they'll be much, much cheaper.
What do you think, Lee? Is it union busting? Is it something having to do with new media? Is it some combination of those things?
I think it's what Charles said, but it's also something that's been going on in the industry for more than the last decade. We all know here at the journalism school that most of our photojournalism majors who we graduate are never going to have full-time jobs. Their whole career is going to be one freelance assignment after the other. The part of it that I lament is that I was very lucky in my professional career to work with a couple of photojournalists who ultimately won Pulitzers and practically every other award you can get. And there's nothing like going out on an assignment with them to give you new kinds of eyes, new ways of thinking about a story. And it's the kind of in-house training that we often don't talk about when we talk about teamwork. So in that sense, what the remaining journalists are going to miss is the training that the photojournalists could have given them. And it's not all about where to point your iPhone. There's just a little more to it than that.
Anybody can take a picture? A photojournalist sees things that the rest of us don't.
Regardless of the cause, Ernest, I'm just wondering how much of this is really an object lesson for other media companies. I mean, after all, it's something of an anomaly that Chicago's a two-newspaper town. So how much should we read into this if we're a news employee or a news manager in another city?
Well, you can bet your bottom dollar, no pun intended, that the rest of the industry is going to look at this. And if things play out the way Charles pretty much put it, which I think he's absolutely right, they're going to follow suit. And this is going to be something that not only will be looked at in terms of photojournalists, but it may also be looked at in terms of the reporters themselves, copy editors, graphic desk. It could really snowball if this plays out that way.
Yeah, clearly, none of us were inside the newsroom. We don't know at least I don't know any of the photographers personally. But I have to wonder, why couldn't the photojournalists there at the Sun-Times have gone out and gathered more web video? Why couldn't they have curated or edited content that was taken by others, including citizen journalists? Why did we have to cut them loose when we could have perhaps just redefined what their job was? Charles, you want to take a stab?
Because it's way cheaper to whack them. They could have repurposed them. You're absolutely right. There's been some commentary on the backside saying that's indeed what they should have done. I think if we were to distribute some truth serum to Sun-Times management, what they'd say is, we don't want to repurpose a $150,000 a year photojournalist when we can repurpose a kid coming out of Missouri for, 45 and no health insurance.
And the thing about it is, you don't have to repurpose that kid coming out of J school because they've already been trained.
We're training them to do that already.
And that's that's the key. That's something that's industry-wide, is that the industry has never been known for training and retraining. And this is one way of not having to, number one, deal with those high salaries. You can get rid of them. And you don't have to worry about training them because the J schools are already doing that. So,
yeah. And let me reframe it a little bit this way, Amy. I mean, I don't know any of the people there, and I'm not trying to cast aspersions, but it seems to me that every employee in every newsroom these days ought at least be conversant with what the organization's digital media requirements are, and they ought to be willing to work beyond their sort of traditional skill set, right?
Well, absolutely. And I'm not that far removed from my time at the Chicago Tribune, left there in the summer of 2010. And at that point, it was expected that everybody have access to a smartphone. If you were in a place where spot news was happening, it was expected that you take a photo with your BlackBerry, your iPhone, whatever you had at that point, and be able to transmit that back to the newspaper right away, because there were times when it would take time for a staff photographer to get there. So there's always been that expectation that that happened.
Well, and among the industry's different sectors, I would say nobody has been more willing broadly to embrace innovation than photojournalism. Mm-hmm. I mean, they have reinvented themselves from static film to digital, from digital to video, from video to multimedia. And I can't imagine that, and I am hearing this undercurrent, Mike, from a lot of the coverage that, well, these guys just didn't get it. They weren't moving in that direction. I'm not sure there's any evidence to support that other than the fact that they were older.
And that's a pretty sweeping conclusion to make of these guys didn't get it. You're talking about 28 people.
But even if we just assume that the reporters who are still there can go out and shoot some quality photos to take video with the right training, I just wonder, and Ernest, maybe you take a stab at this, can those reporters be expected to go out there and capture quality images while they're also writing, interviewing, tweeting, blogging? Is that possible?
No, it's not possible. Because I think it goes back to what Amy was talking about. Photojournalists are trained to see certain things that writers aren't. And they've been doing it for a while, not only in their training, but also in just their everyday lives. And you're going to miss that on the visual end. And anyone who knows anything about today's journalism, the visuals is what draws people in. It draws the audience in. And they just pretty much gave away all of that, or let that go out the door, all of that experience and knowledge.
Lee, when we mentioned we were going to talk about this topic, you argued in an email, at least, that maybe we should have seen this coming a while back, and that maybe schools like ours should stop fooling students into thinking there are plenty of career opportunities as photojournalists. Is that a little harsh, or do you think that's real?
Well, I think in many ways we have to stop fooling students into thinking that they're going to get jobs as staff photographers. Those jobs don't exist anymore. To amplify the point that Ernest was making, it's not the spot news. That's what photojournalists stopped taking pictures of a long, long time ago, unless it was just by sheer dumb luck. It's the photo essay. It's the thing that's actually worth sending a photographer out and having that person be there for more than 15 minutes to get that one picture that contains a ton of information. I mean, it seems to me that one of the things that management here has lost track of is that pictures, photo images aren't illustrations. They're actually the conveyors of information. A good photojournalist adds information to the story, and I agree with Ernest. That's what they're going to discover they're missing.
Yeah, well, I would say that the desire to get arresting images certainly played a part in the tragedy in Oklahoma City last week. We know that the series of violent tornadoes that came through there killed 18 people now. That's the latest death toll, including a veteran storm chaser, his partner, and his son. Now, colleagues say that Tim Samaras was a careful, well-trained professional, but as one weather researcher told Oklahoma City's KOCO-TV, that's becoming the exception rather than the rule as storm chasing becomes more popular.
If you put yourself 100 yards away from debris flying, you put yourself in pretty grave danger.
Mike Ailes knows a lot about tornadoes. He was part of the research team that the movie Twister was based on. He thinks storm chasing has gone too far.
It's no longer pictures of tornadoes that people want. It's video of debris or buildings blowing up or trees being blown around. So people are taking, I think, big, big chances.
But it's not just scientists and videographers. Thrill seekers hoping to capture chaos up close. Tornado tours are big business in these parts.
Just like people go to see the whales and everything else, they want to see tornadoes. They want to see the big ones. So that's what we do.
Well, how much responsibility do you think, Ernest, do the news media have for this risk-taking on the part of the storm chasers, whether they're experts or amateurs?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say that the news media had any culpability in this. I think what tends to happen is that when you have these storms and all of a sudden you have these shows that are spawned off of it. Weather Channel has tornadoes shows that they put on outside of the tornado season. You have the same thing going on in the History Channel and on Discovery Channel, and people see this and they go, wow, this is pretty great. Well, next time a tornado comes up, then maybe I'll go out and see if I can capture some video and turn it in to CNN or Discovery or the Weather Channel, and then this is what you have.
Well, now, Lee, Ernest kind of jumped quickly over the news media's responsibility and went to reality TV shows, and we've got YouTube there too, but would you agree that maybe that the news media are also making celebrities out of these folks?
I think we're very culpable on a couple of levels. I'll disagree with Ernest here. One, it goes back to our previous topic. We'll publish anything, including people being stupid. And the minute you publish somebody being stupid or you air somebody being stupid, you encourage other people to model that admittedly very stupid behavior. The second thing I think we've got here is an interesting part of life interacting with art. I think people don't understand that the images in Twister had a lot of help from Hollywood, mm-hmm. a lot of help from digitization.
The flying cow wasn't real,
although apparently there were flying horses. And so what all of this means is that people are trying to capture something that in reality doesn't exist. So we dangle the carrot out there and people try to go and eat it. And then we say, oh, no, we're not responsible. I'm sorry. I just can't accept that. We're very responsible.
But I think what's missing here is the tragedy of the situation, the aftermath of the tornadoes. And I think that that's missing from the story, because we spend so much time, and I'm talking about the news media here, we spend so much time talking about, you know, the event itself, and we don't carry that event all the way through. So in that regard, I do think that the media has some culpability.
I wonder, with regard to the storm chasers, if it's really just the amateurs who need to get off the road or be more safe, because not only did we have these three professionals who were killed, but we also had the Weather Channel crew that was tossed about 200 yards, and if it hadn't been for their airbags, probably some of them would be dead too, Amy.
Well, one of the things about this crew of three that died Friday night, they weren't out there simply for the thrill of it. They weren't out there for adrenaline. They weren't out there even just on behalf of the news media. These were scientists who, from all of the coverage we've seen in the tributes to date, these folks were out there gathering real weather data that was being used for scientific research purposes, not just for entertainment.
Yeah, and I think we obviously still need scientists out there to help us understand the process of tornadoes, how they form, where they go, and all of that. Nobody would dispute that. Well, one other topic I'd like to discuss briefly, and I'm going to start with Charles, is yesterday's story from the Associated Press showing that top Obama administration officials have secret email accounts that they use to conduct official government business. Now, we don't know what they're using them for. We don't know how many of these secret addresses exist, because so far, 10 of the federal agencies that the AP contacted with an open records request have not responded. But we do know that the directors of Health and Human Services and Labor have them. And this practice, I think, is raising some really troubling questions about transparency. For example, the HES initially refused to turn over the email addresses of Department Secretary Kathleen Sebelius. The Labor Department tried to charge AP $1 million to pull the records, right? And last year, a conservative think tank discovered that the head of the EPA was actually using an alias, a fictitious employee's name, to converse with environmentalists by one of these secret accounts. So what do we make of all that,
John? Yeah, well, there are varying degrees of complexity and difficulty in the story, because there's a lot of confluence going on. I've seen comments under the story going, this is just like Sarah Palin in Alaska. It's not. It's troubling. It makes it extraordinarily difficult to find information when government officials use multiple aliases, especially when they use secret aliases. Now, that's just flat wrong in the EPA case. What's happening here is that they have dual addresses. So they'll have a kathleen.sebelius@hhs.gov, and then they'll have some kkbs@hhs.gov, where she communicates with her own inner sanctum. Potentially troubling if it's not discoverable under FOIA, not troubling on its face because all it is a second address. Very different than Sarah Palin using, you know, grizzlybear@hotmail.com, which was subject to no FOI law. Right. Theoretically, these are supposed to be obtainable under FOI law. Problem is, if you're not archiving carefully and storing these, you're never going to find that information. And therein lies the real difficulty. They're making archival systems that simply will not work.
Yeah. Well, as I mentioned at the top, we're initiating a changing of the guard here at Views of the News. This is Lee and Charles' last show, at least until they return to campus as guests of the J School. We hope you'll do that sometime. Lee, you're off to Wayne State University in Detroit. What are you going to be doing there?
I'm going to be the chair of the Department of Communication, which includes journalism, in a very different environment with a very different kind of student body.
So what's the challenge there, and how is it different from here?
It's different from here in the sense that it's obviously urban. It's different from here in the sense that Wayne State, although it's a research university, also has what's pretty close to an open admissions policy. So their student body looks very different. A lot of first-time college students, a lot of people of color, and a lot more diversity on that level.
Well, you said that you were thinking of a Views of the News type program there, so say a little bit more about that.
Well, I've already talked to the general manager of the NPR station there, who at least hasn't told me that I'm crazy on my face. One of the wonderful things about Detroit is that it's a great news town if you want to cover government and corruption. So clearly there would be lots of things for us to talk about.
Well, Charles, why don't you remind the audience of your new job at an old stomping ground?
Yes, as of July 1, I'll be the new dean of the Henry W. Grady College of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Georgia.
Why don't you just say a little bit, maybe I'm putting you on the spot just a little bit, but okay. Talk about some of the more important things you think we've talked about over the years on this program, or what issues in news media performance kind of stuck in your mind?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think there have been a couple of themes. Obviously, I spend a lot of time thinking and talking, and you've been good enough to ask me questions about government transparency and the role, the very corrosive role, I think, that government secrecy plays in a democracy. And I think we have done a good job, thanks to your leadership, of pointing at examples of sort of secrecy run amok. I also think that we were early on talking about the wrenching transformation to the digital world before it was even cool. I can remember being on the fourth floor of Jesse a long time, longer ago than I care to admit, talking about these very subjects and having a really, for views, I think, fairly heated exchange among several of us about how significant we thought the move to online journalism was. And now you look back, that was probably 10 years ago. You look back now and just kind of giggle thinking about how silly that was.
Well, Lee, you've been on this program even more than 10 years. You and I were sort of the original guests of Rod Gillette, among other folks. So as you're thinking back over all that time, what sticks out in your mind?
What I'm told by people who listen other than my family members is that it's refreshing to hear people sort of critique their own profession. And one of the things that I've really enjoyed doing and being a part of with all the people who've been on Views is sort of trying to unpack how does this happen? How does the process get made so that, you know, listeners, viewers, whatever can better understand it. And, you know, like Charles, I have my intellectual passion, which is ethics. And so it's been great, although humbling and occasionally humiliating, to talk about ethics live, frequently, very much on the spot, and to see if I can help others make sense of it.
Well, Amy, in all those 10 years that Charles was referring to, you've been working in the front lines of online media. So what's your thinking about as we move ahead with some of the things that we're going to need to pay more attention to?
Well, we're going to be looking at the growing use of social media and the ethics that come in with that. We're going to be looking at how different government agencies, and this is something that you were talking about, Charles, as a guest on Intersection earlier this week, how they're going directly to the audience using social channels and how our job is going to be challenged and our profession will be challenged to continue to be that fourth estate between government and between our audiences and the public. And I think we're just going to be looking at what hopefully is an emergence from some very challenging economic times for our industry and to see what it looks like on the other side.
Well, in earnest, as one of our resident historians, part of your job is to look back and apply those lessons to the future. So what sorts of things are you looking forward to monitoring and making sure the audience keeps up with?
Well, one of the things is that this is making sure that we do connect with the audience. I think sometimes, and Charles mentioned this earlier, talk about the 30,000 feet navel gazing that we tend to do in journalism a lot. And one of the things that I hope we can talk more about is how journalism can connect through social media, through the traditional ways that we've always presented news and information to the audience, and not forget that they're out there and they want to be able to connect and engage.
Well, as Views regulars know, Lee accepted an additional assignment during those weeks that I was out of town over the past 5 years. She was our substitute host and did an outstanding job, notwithstanding these bloopers that we pulled at her expense.
I know.
All right.
Good evening, and welcome to Views of the Nose.
Views of your nose.
Sorry. Okay, we need to start over again. Guys, we're going to have to start again because I made the little button do the wrong thing. Okay, guys, we've got to stop again because now the prompter's gone blank. Welcome to Views of the News, the show that this week is going to focus on the issues surrounding doing journalism and... God bless it! Okay, third time better be the charm.
So, Amy, you know what you're in for as the new substitute host.
That was great.
I've set a very low bar, Amy. You'll be great.
I hate to think what our director, Travis McMillan, has in store for me if I ever step into the you said. Well, to get serious for a moment, let's reflect just a little bit on what we do each week, which is media criticism. And I just wonder if you could say how importantly you think that that basic discipline is as we're going forward.
The basic discipline is essential. It's always been essential for us in the classroom. I think that the audience doesn't understand that a lot of teaching journalism is pulling things apart for students and showing them how to do it better, differently, whatever. But I think we're lucky. We work in a college town there. We have lots of smart listeners. And to have them be a part of that process is very important in what the audience, to get back to Ernest's point, expects of journalists.
You get the last word on that subject for today, at least, Charles.
Well, I agree, and I think it is. You just said something really profound, and that is we live in a smart town. I have encountered through the years so many people at the grocery store line, the car wash, whatever, who have engaged me on something that we talked about the week before or the day before in insightful, thoughtful, remarkable ways.
Okay, well, we had some fun with Lee a few minutes ago, but as we say goodbye to her and Charles, we thought you might like to see and hear some vintage Wilkins and Davis from the past 5 years.
Oh, God.
Good evening. It's Wednesday, December 10th, 2008, and this is KBIA's Views of the News.
There was a great story in the New York Times this morning looking
they
at
they didn't actually benefit the much from the coverage.
I'm a teacher, one of the very frightening things about the series was, since I teach ethics, I can imagine someone coming into my classroom giving students an ethics test.
Where the cold wind blows, tomorrow never knows.
Why don't we practice it? I mean, we preach it all the time, but then you watch it and we violate that rule over and over.
I admit, you know, being a member of the female persuasion made me a bit sensitive, is that women need training on how to go on camera, but men don't?
Yeah.
I just, what is going on here?
KOMU has this unbelievably painful video from around the world segment. It ought to be entitled, "We found some random video from somewhere in the world that has nothing to do whatsoever with what happened in the world today, but it's really cool video."
So do we just stop talking about polls because they're accurate, but they're telling us things that we don't want to know?
Doggone, they're accurate.
But we've undercovered what the actual experience has been.
Nice play on words there.
Oh, sorry about that, Rod.
Kudos to Fox. I mean, this is a moment of transparency, I think.
Isn't that what we wanted?
Come out of the closet and said, you know what? This is us.
Is that adequate disclosure?
It's not adequate disclosure. On the other hand, it's the New York Post, which in my view ought to come in a plain brown wrapper.
You look at the numbers. Nancy Grace, you know, whatever that is, I hesitate to even call an opinion.
So, yeah, soundbite culture, but, man, we're the folks who started it, and I think we are the people who can stop it.
I can't imagine that putting Sarah Palin in any setting in which she speaks live into a television camera is not fraught with risk.
And before we get too maudlin here on the set, it's time to wrap up this week's program. My heartfelt thanks to good friends Lee Wilkins and Charles Davis. We wish them great success in their new endeavors. Thanks to Amy Simons and Ernest Perry, who are going to agree to fill some very big shoes in the months ahead. Thanks to our technical team, RJI's Travis McMillan and KBIA's Pat Akers. And thanks to you for watching and listening. Our Views podcast is available under the Talk Shows tab at kbia.org. You'll also find links to media related to each week's topics there. We welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions via email. The address is views@kbia.org. I'm Mike McKean. Please join Amy, Ernest, and me next Wednesday for another edition of KBIA's Views of the News.